John F. Kennedy with Oswald. It's highly unlikely that an experienced godfather like Marcello would spend a year carefully planning JFK's assassination, only to entrust the shooting to an inexperienced young man who was out of practice with a rifle and was not a very good shot the last time he was tested in the Marines. In addition, Marcello told Van Lanningham that he had brought two hitmen over from Europe to shoot JFK, as mentioned in Chapter 1 and detailed in Chapter 12. Marcello's admission about the two hitmen was recorded on FBI undercover audio tape. Carlos Marcello's account to Van Lanningham about meeting Oswald fits with much information that would only become public knowledge years later, with the 1989 publication of Mafia Kingfish, Marcello's biography by John H. Davis. Van Lanningham's account of the Marcello-Oswald meeting in the FBI files was written the year before Davis's book came out. Long overlooked FBI files from the days, weeks, and months after JFK's assassination, including files that had not been published or cited in any book when Van Lanningham's written account for the FBI was prepared, also furnish corroboration for the meeting. FBI memos first published in Davis's Marcello biography describe Oswald getting money from one of Marcello's men at the restaurant of the Town and Country Motel. The nondescript motel on Airline Highway, far from the tawdry glitz of the French Quarter, served as Marcello's headquarters. The meeting occurred in late February or early March 1963. That fits the time frame when Oswald was briefly in New Orleans, where he was interviewed in jail by the INS agent and claimed to be Cuban. According to the FBI memos, Oswald was sitting in the mostly empty dining room when the FBI source saw the restaurant's owner remove a wad of bills from his pocket, which he passed under the table to the man sitting at the table, whom the source identified as Oswald. The FBI's source was a businessman from Darien, Georgia, named Gene Sumner. His brother-in-law was a police lieutenant in the area, and several days after JFK's murder, Sumner told him what he had seen the previous winter. Sumner's brother-in-law then contacted the FBI, as recorded in a November 26, 1963 memo. As with all the dozen-plus associates of Carlos Marcello that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI interviewed following JFK's assassination, the investigation of this incident was cursory and routine. Hoover had stated publicly that Oswald had acted alone, and agents knew that crossing Hoover would end their careers. Sumner described the man he thought was the owner of the restaurant, the man he saw giving Oswald money, as being 6 feet tall, which means he wasn't Carlos Marcello. One of Marcello's brothers was the legal owner of the Town and Country, while a top lieutenant for Marcello, Joseph Pareto, managed the restaurant. The FBI interviewed both, and, of course, they denied knowing Oswald. Davis notes a variety of logical avenues of investigation that the FBI did not pursue, interviewing Sumner's companions that night, checking the records of the hotel where Sumner stayed to establish the exact date, and showing Sumner a photo of the restaurant's manager. When the FBI sent the information to the Warren Commission, it excluded important details about the mafia from the report. These included the facts that the man who gave Oswald money admitted involvement in the rackets, that Sumner's associate that night had a father who was formerly a racketeer and was known to the restaurant's owner, and that the Town and Country was a known hangout for the hoodlum element. This fits the pattern, noted by congressional investigators and Hoover expert Anthony Summers, of Hoover's FBI downplaying the organized crime ties of Marcello and his associates. Hoover also withheld FBI field reports like this one from Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who would have immediately grasped its significance. John H. Davis was also the first to report that Marcello briefly mentioned the FBI interviews of his brother and Pareto to the FBI's Brilab informant, Joe Hauser. Carlos Marcello told Hauser, "The feds came to the motel asking about him, but my people didn't tell him nothing. Like we never heard of the guy, you know?" Hauser's credibility on this point is enhanced because at the time he heard the remarks, the Sumner incident had never been mentioned in any book. Shortly after the payoff Sumner witnessed, Oswald moved to New Orleans to stay with his bookie uncle, Dutz Murrett. Murrett, Bannister, and Ferry weren't the only links between Marcello and Oswald. The House Select Committee on Assassinations uncovered other ties between Oswald, his family, and the Marcello organization. As summarized in Vanity Fair, Oswald's childhood and youth had been spent in New Orleans, where Oswald's mother's friends included a corrupt lawyer linked to Marcello's crime operation and a man who served Marcello as bodyguard and chauffeur. In the summer of 1963, Oswald was bailed out of jail by a man close to one of Marcello's oldest friends, Nofio Picora, the same man who was called 3 weeks before the assassination by Jack Ruby. Lending further credence to Marcello's remarks about Oswald is that fact that FBI files contain other accurate information that Van Lanningham had written down that Marcello told him about Ferry. The Godfather said that Ferry was an ex-airline pilot. It seems that he flew to Guatemala to pick up some new papers that Marcello needed to fight the INS in a court case. Ferry admitted to authorities soon after JFK's assassination that shortly before JFK was murdered, he had flown to Guatemala twice for Marcello regarding his deportation case. At the time Van Lanningham reported Marcello's account to the FBI, Ferry's work for Marcello was not well known by the general public or even most historians. Carlos Marcello also told Jack Van Lanningham about his control of Jack Ruby, including an important meeting that took place in 1963, more than 5 months before JFK's murder. Marcello's 1985 remarks about Ruby are briefly summarized in the Camtex FBI file, but Van Lanningham added more important information in our talks. By the spring of 1963, Jack Ruby owed a small fortune to the IRS, almost $160,000 in today's dollars, and was desperate for money. The IRS filed tax liens against Ruby on March 13, 1963, and Ruby faced ruin unless he could find another source of money to pay his bills. According to Carlos Marcello, Ruby found the money he needed by taking it from cash that flowed through the Carousel Club. As Marcello explained to Jack Van Lanningham years later, his organization actually controlled the Carousel Strip Club. Ruby merely managed it. Since the club was across the street from Dallas's most distinguished hotel, the Adolphus, whenever conventions or company meetings were held at the hotel, business at the Carousel was especially brisk, and Ruby probably figured it would be easy to skim some of the proceeds for his own pressing financial needs. Marcello had hidden ownership of several clubs in Dallas, and his financial operatives would have known what all the clubs should be making at particular times of the year. When the Carousel came up short compared to in previous years or other clubs, it wouldn't have been hard for Marcello's people to confirm Jack's ongoing theft. Marcello would have been furious that a longtime mobster like Ruby would take such action, knowing the deadly consequences if caught. However, just as in 1959, Jack Ruby was once again the right person in the right situation at the right time to help Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante. Beginning in late April 1963, Ruby became of great interest to Marcello, and not just for his skimming. The former director of the House Select Committee on Assassinations wrote that, though the Warren Commission apparently believed that press speculation about the president's trip to Dallas did not begin until September 13, 1963, a story in the Dallas Times-Herald on April 24, 1963, quoted Vice President Johnson as saying that President Kennedy might visit Dallas and other major Texas cities that summer. Starting the following month, the HSCA discovered a pattern of Ruby telephone calls to individuals with criminal affiliations, calls that could only be described as suspicious. Jack Ruby's well-documented long-distance phone calls provide a clear record that he was becoming involved in something quite unusual by May 1963. After making fewer than 10 long-distance calls in April 1963, Ruby suddenly more than doubled that total to 25 in May and more than 30 in June. He continued on that approximate pace through September, but after JFK's trip to Dallas began firming up for November, Ruby's total skyrocketed to more than 80 long-distance calls in October 1963 and more than 110 in just the first 3 weeks of November. Even in those calls, Ruby would have relied on coded words and phrases common in transacting mafia business, often going through one or more intermediaries to get information to its ultimate destination. Carlos Marcello gave Jack Van Lanningham the Godfather's own unvarnished view of Jack Ruby. According to the FBI file, in talking about Jack Ruby, Marcello said he had met him in Dallas, Texas. He set him up in the bar business there. He said that Ruby was a homo son of a bitch, but good to have around to report to him what was happening in town. Marcello told us that all the police were on the take, and as long as he kept the money flowing, they let him operate anything in Dallas that he wanted to. Ruby would come to Churchill Farms to report to Marcello, so the little man knew what was happening all the time. Marcello's admission about Ruby goes beyond anything known previously, but makes sense in light of information uncovered by congressional investigators and the FBI. It's important to remember that Ruby's ties to the mafia were completely unknown to the general public until the late 1970s, and even then, most writers overlooked Ruby's connections to several of Marcello's close associates. Even the landmark biography of Ruby by Seth Cantor, 1978's Who Was Jack Ruby, didn't mention Marcello, though it was the first book to outline Ruby's ties to numerous other mobsters. Dallas reporter Eric Goltz was one of the first to clearly make the connection between Ruby and Marcello's organization and Marcello's control of Vice in Dallas, a link soon confirmed by the 1979 House Select Committee on Assassinations report. However, it was not until the extensive print and television coverage that accompanied the 25th anniversary of JFK's murder in November 1988 and publication of Marcello's biography by John Davis in January 1989, that the general public really began to learn about Ruby's ties to the mob. It's important to note that Van Lanningham's report on Marcello's remarks about Ruby was written up and in FBI files well before that. In contrast to the way the FBI presented Ruby to the public and the Warren Commission, the Bureau's own files from 1963 and earlier confirmed Ruby's close ties to the mafia. A formerly secret FBI damage control memo, first published by historian Gerald D. McKnight in 2005, was actually prepared by the Bureau in the late 1970s in case it had to defend its investigation into the Kennedy assassination. This was a type of tickler memo, highlighting problems and information the FBI knew it had withheld from the public and press. The FBI damage control memo regarding Jack Ruby admits that the Bureau had extensive teletypes and reports on his organized crime connections. In contrast to that secret internal admission, the FBI essentially used statements from several of Ruby's mob associates to claim to the commission that Ruby had no mob associates. Other statements Marcello made to Van Lanningham are easily confirmed. Even today, most people are unaware that Jack Ruby was gay or bisexual, even though such information comes up almost 40 times in Warren Commission documents, and Ruby's roommate at the time of JFK's murder described himself as Ruby's boyfriend. FBI files also back up Marcello's remark that in Dallas, all the police were on the take, and as long as he kept the money flowing, they let him operate anything in Dallas that he wanted to. FBI memos mentioned earlier and made available to the Warren Commission but not mentioned in its widely published report say that Ruby was well acquainted with virtually every officer of the Dallas Police Force and was the payoff man for the Dallas Police Department. With the FBI holding such information close to its vest, journalists and historians had to ferret out the details of Ruby's involvement with the mob and Marcello's men bit by bit. Almost 4 years after Marcello's 1985 admission to Jack Van Lanningham, which was withheld from the public at the time and for the next 20 years, John H. Davis detailed tantalizing connections between Ruby and several Marcello associates. These included Marcello's Dallas mob lieutenants Joe Civello and Joe Campisi, Sr. Campisi was the first person to visit Ruby in prison after he shot Oswald. He also met with Ruby the night before JFK's murder. Davis documented that in the months and weeks leading up to JFK's assassination, Ruby visited or made calls to five people in Marcello's organization. In addition to those five, Davis writes, it appears that Jack Ruby knew at least two of Carlos Marcello's brothers via the slot machine and strip club businesses. The most startling admission about Ruby that Carlos Marcello made to Van Lanningham concerned a dramatic meeting that Ruby was summoned to, where the Godfather confronted Ruby about stealing his money and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Van Lanningham is a large man with a deep voice, and he is normally good-natured. However, when he first related to me what Marcello told him about that meeting, he took on the menacing tone that Marcello conveyed to Ruby at that meeting. Marcello confronted Ruby in the old farmhouse in the middle of his 6,400-acre Churchill Farms property. Most of it had once been swampland, and some of it still was. Marcello disposed of the bodies of men who crossed him at Churchill Farms, a fact not lost on any member of the Godfather's organization summoned there for a meeting. Recall Marcello's murder of Thomas Siracusa, described in Chapter 4. His body, according to the FBI, was thrown into a tub of lye, and after decomposition, the partially liquefied remains were poured into the swamp. Ruby, knowing he was stealing money from Marcello, was probably already nervous when he arrived at the isolated farmhouse. One can only imagine his fear and pleading when Marcello confronted him about his thievery and the fury Marcello unleashed on him. As Marcello described the scene to Van Lanningham, Ruby was trembling and begging, willing to do anything to keep from paying the ultimate price for stealing from the Godfather. If it eventually meant going into a crowded police basement full of well-armed cops, pulling out his gun and shooting a prisoner, Ruby had no choice but to do it. As indicated by Ruby's later remarks, it was likely not just Ruby's life that was on the line, but those of his family, two brothers, a sister, nieces, and nephews, as well. An undoubtedly grateful Ruby left the meeting with his life, but would become increasingly involved in the dangerous JFK plot. As with any sensitive mafia operation, Ruby's participation would be on a need-to-know basis, getting only limited amounts of information about the plot when he needed to know it. The FBI has released files with Marcello's remarks about Ruby, written in the 1980s, and we also have Jack Van Lanningham's videotaped oral history with additional details about Marcello's Ruby comments. Marcello's revelations were also recorded by the FBI's secret Camtex taping system. However, none of the Camtex tapes or transcripts have been released as the 1992 JFK Act requires, and they should be, so that the public can hear Marcello's own words about the matter. Using information compiled by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, it's possible to pinpoint the likely time of Marcello's confrontation with Ruby. Committee investigators compiled detailed information on Ruby's many calls and visits to New Orleans in 1963, usually to people or places connected to Marcello. But they were unable to find out where Ruby stayed during his visit to New Orleans from June 5 to June 8, 1963. One journalist has suggested that Ruby may have stayed at Churchill Farms during that time, which would account for the lack of any record. Ruby had called a Marcello associate several times before that visit, and Ruby called a club run by one of Marcello's brothers 2 days after he returned to Dallas. FBI files show that on June 22, 1963, 2 weeks after Ruby's visit to New Orleans, a horse trainer for one of Carlos Marcello's brothers said he was in a bookie joint in New Orleans where he worked part-time. The horse trainer told the FBI that another one of Marcello's brothers came in and spoke to the owner. The trainer overheard Marcello's brother say, "The word is out to get the Kennedy family." In 1963, as in 1959, Jack Ruby was not a major player, but had been given an offer he couldn't refuse because he knew the right people in the right places. Ruby worked in a city controlled by Carlos Marcello, a city that was expected to be visited by JFK. In Cuba, Ruby had met and tried to help Santo Traficante, and he was familiar with Tampa, having once lived there and sometimes visiting the city while scouting strip acts. Ruby had worked for Johnny Rosselli's Chicago Mafia and knew that city well. Jimmy Hoffa's son admits that his father knew Jack Ruby. The mob bosses and Hoffa had more than a dozen associates in common with Ruby, making it easy to communicate with Ruby through intermediaries. As Ruby's phone records confirm, Ruby was also a small part of Marcello and Traficante's drug network, which would also figure into the JFK plot. Finally, Ruby had the connections with the Dallas police to arrange for anyone blamed for the assassination in Dallas to be quickly killed. If that didn't happen, Ruby would have to do the job himself, and the same would likely be true if the assassination occurred in a city besides Dallas. In preparation for Ruby's help with the JFK plot and to provide cover for his activities, he may have been given a small role in the CIA Mafia Castro assassination plots. By the fall of 1963, Jack Ruby would be having face-to-face meetings with Johnny Rosselli in Miami while the CIA Mafia plots to kill Castro were continuing. Carlos Marcello had also apparently given Ruby a substantial financial incentive for producing results in his work on the JFK plot. Several months after the Marcello meeting, and shortly before JFK's trip to Dallas, Ruby began to make plans to move away from the lower middle-class Oak Cliff neighborhood. He planned for a new home in the most expensive and exclusive part of Dallas, Turtle Creek, where prominent citizens such as General Edwin Walker lived. Also, around that time, Ruby talked to his tax attorney, claiming he had a connection who would supply him money to settle his long-standing and huge IRS debt. In a few months, Ruby had gone from being desperate for money to being afraid of being killed to feeling like he was finally ready to hit the financial big time. Ruby had one more set of skills that made him valuable to Marcello and Traficante in their JFK plot: his experience with Cuba and gun running. Cuba would provide the Godfathers the key they needed to kill JFK in a way that would prevent U.S. high officials from conducting a truly thorough investigation to avoid exposing secrets that could trigger, in the words of one memo, World War III. Chapter 9. Marcello and Traficante infiltrate JFK's secret Cuba plan. By the spring of 1963, Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and Johnny Rosselli had the motive to assassinate President Kennedy, and in many ways the CIA Mafia plots to kill Castro provided the means. CIA Deputy Director for Plans Richard Helms was still hiding those plots from John and Robert Kennedy and his own CIA director. By using people linked to those operations in their still-developing plan to assassinate JFK, the Mafia chiefs could employ people and equipment for what appeared to be CIA operations, but later some would seem to be linked to JFK's assassination, forcing CIA officials, such as Helms, to cover up or destroy much crucial information. After all, in 1963, high U.S. government officials could not afford to let the world know they were trying to topple or kill a foreign leader such as Castro only months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, especially using dangerous criminals. However, Marcello and the other mob bosses needed something more than the CIA Mafia plots to trigger a truly widespread cover-up, one that would ensure there could be no thorough and complete investigation of JFK's murder. Fear of revealing any possible link between the CIA Mafia plots and JFK's assassination would cause Helms and his close subordinates to hide important information from investigators. However, the Godfathers also needed a way to force CIA Director John McCone, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, and new President Lyndon Johnson to withhold crucial information from the press and public to prevent a potential nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. The CIA and the Mafia worked together on two well-documented attempts to kill Fidel Castro in the spring of 1963, efforts that would later be linked to JFK's assassination by the Mafia. These two attempts aren't well known and are missing from the CIA's later accounts of the CIA Mafia plots. However, Cuban authorities extensively documented the two attempts, having captured many of the Cuban participants and much of their CIA-supplied armaments and communications equipment. The Cubans photographed both men and material at the time, and the full details reached the American press a decade later. Both of these attempts involved Mafia Don Johnny Rosselli, operating under the supervision of CIA officer William Harvey. Harvey, a hard-drinking, rotund agent sometimes called America's James Bond, was becoming close friends with Rosselli, who was an expert at manipulating people for his own ends. The first of the two attempts was on March 13, 1963, and was described in Cuban accounts as involving a plan to assassinate Castro from a house near the University of Havana, shooting with a mortar and other weapons. Cuban forces captured and photographed bazookas, mortars, and machine guns, along with an assassination team of five men, including one named as a CIA agent. According to the account, the instructions for the attempted assassination were given by the CIA through Guantanamo Naval Base. Naval War College historian David Kaiser documented that Johnny Rosselli identified the team as his own twice in later years. 4 years after the attempt, Rosselli and his attorney spread provocative stories to select journalists, accounts that reached President Lyndon Johnson and other high-ranking U.S. officials. Rosselli's later story claimed that the team had been tortured and captured and had confessed that they were on an official mission for the U.S. government, and that this led to Castro's decision to arrange the assassination of Kennedy. Rosselli would leak the story again in 1971, adding even more details, including William Harvey's name. In planting those and similar fake stories, blaming JFK's murder on Fidel, Rosselli, Traficante, and Marcello not only diverted blame for JFK's murder away from themselves, but also ensured that it couldn't be fully investigated without exposing dark secrets the CIA and other high officials didn't want revealed. According to a 1975 Miami Herald article, an even larger CIA attempt to kill Fidel occurred at the Latin American Stadium on April 7, 1963. It involved 16 men armed with pistols and fragmentation grenades. At least three of the men were captured and photographed, along with a large array of weapons, including sniper rifles, machine guns, assault rifles, and pistols. Based on Rosselli's later remarks, that attempt was also part of his CIA Mafia plotting. However, those two attempts wouldn't have provided enough cover for Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli. Because Robert Kennedy and the CIA director didn't know about U.S. backing for the attempts, they wouldn't have had the same motivation as Richard Helms to cover up information if they were linked to JFK's murder. So, an embittered John Martino, an associate of Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli, helped concoct a plot designed to secure the backing of the CIA director and the Kennedys, a plot that was really about providing the Mafia cover for its planned assassination of JFK. Martino found some powerful allies for his planned operation, including wealthy and influential William Pauley, a friend of former Vice President Richard Nixon and Senator James O. Eastland, who was investigating the Fair Play for Cuba Committee at the time. The CIA officially authorized Martino's plan, put together with the help of Rosselli and Traficante, and codenamed it Operation Tilt. Martino's story was designed to appeal to the CIA and to JFK, and was compelling, though far-fetched. The plan's stated goal was to send a 10-man Cuban exile team into Cuba to bring back three Soviet technicians who were supposedly ready to defect and reveal that Soviet nuclear missiles remained hidden in caves in Cuba. The scenario sounded plausible to CIA officials because thousands of Soviet technicians and troops remained in Cuba. Fidel had never allowed the UN weapons inspections, so there was no way to prove with absolute certainty that some missiles weren't hidden in caves or underground, beyond the view of American U-2 spy plane flights. For President Kennedy, if Cuba still held on to Soviet missiles, he wanted to be the first to know, before his political enemies used the information to attack him. However, JFK, RFK, and their aides were skeptical of the story and didn't become involved in the operation. Martino and his mobster bosses pressed ahead with the plan, hoping one or more JFK aides might decide to support the operation. The story did appeal to the nation's most popular weekly news photo magazine, Life, which promised to give each of the three Soviet defectors $2,500 in return for their stories. However, Dr. Kaiser found that Roselli and Trafficante were using Martino as a cutout to enlist the help of the CIA for the operation. Historian Richard Mahoney documented that Operation Tilt was actually an early attempt to lay the groundwork for the Mafia's plot to assassinate JFK. Mahoney wrote that it fit nicely with Roselli's later claim that President Kennedy was assassinated by an anti-Castro sniper team sent in to murder Castro, captured by the Cubans, tortured, and redeployed in Dallas. Martino's 10-man exile team to be sent into Cuba was originally going to include Lauren Hall, a U.S. mercenary who had earlier spent time in detention with Santo Trafficante in Cuba. Kaiser wrote that John Martino asked Hall if he might be interested in something bigger than a raid, backed by people from Chicago and Miami. Hall was then taken to meetings in Miami in April 1963, first with Trafficante and then with Giancana and Roselli. Martino explained that the assassination of Castro was the real object of the raid. Hall, smelling something fishy, wisely stayed out of the operation. Eventually, a team of 10 armed Cuban exiles headed off toward Cuba, watched by a photographer from Life magazine, two CIA agents, and John Martino. The team never returned, and Cuban government officials claim the 10 never landed in Cuba. In reality, no Soviet technicians waited, ready to defect. The entire story had been a ruse by Roselli and Trafficante, spread by Martino to CIA officials. Kaiser points out that ample evidence, however, shows that the raid was actually just another mob plot against Castro's life, having nothing to do with Soviet technicians, and that it was sold to the agency under a false cover. As noted by historian Mahoney, the mob boss's real goal was to provide cover for JFK's assassination. It's important to note that by the spring of 1963, Trafficante, Roselli, and Marcello would have no longer seen killing Fidel as their highest priority. The pressure on the mob chiefs from JFK and RFK had increased by that time. Carlos Marcello faced federal charges later in the year and knew he would be personally prosecuted by RFK's men. Trafficante's operations were under increasing assault, and their ally, Jimmy Hoffa, faced three trials for various crimes. Roselli's boss, Sam Giancana, was severely impacted by the FBI's lockstep surveillance. Killing Fidel Castro while JFK and RFK were still in power would do the mob bosses little good, which meant that murdering JFK was much more important and time-sensitive for the Mafia chiefs. Ultimately, there was a major problem with Roselli and Trafficante's plan. John and Robert Kennedy never supported Operation Tilt. Because they also knew nothing about the CIA Mafia plots in March and April 1963, RFK would have no incentive to protect those operations if they appeared linked to his brother's murder. Fortuitously for the mobsters, by the time Operation Tilt ended in early summer 1963, a new U.S. operation against Cuba had evolved. It was one the Kennedys fully supported and directed, and that three Mafia leaders would soon infiltrate. In penetrating this operation, the mob bosses would gain access to sensitive information that could compromise various branches of government, stifling any real investigation of JFK's murder until at least the late 1970s. By April 1963, Kennedy administration policy about Cuba had become muddled, according to accounts for the various subcommittees of the National Security Council dealing with Cuba. Some officials pressed for strong action, while others called for a more cautious approach. JFK didn't want Cuba to dominate the headlines as it had during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's why he and his officials were careful not to remind the public that there was not yet a no-invasion pledge, because Fidel had not yet allowed UN weapons inspectors into Cuba. Yet the secret war against Cuba, run out of Miami's huge JM Wave station, continued, with extravagant sums being spread among dozens of exile groups, large and small. By the early spring of 1963, JFK had approved small exile raids against Cuban ships, but ships of other countries were not supposed to be attacked. However, Richard Helms appears to have taken a harder line against Cuba on his own, again without telling JFK or CIA Director McCone, which caused problems for President Kennedy. For example, one CIA-backed Cuban exile group that Helms supported made an unauthorized attack in Cuba that violated JFK's guidelines. On March 18, 1963, a group named Alpha 66, run by exile Antonio Veciana, announced that it had attacked a Russian ship and a Russian training area in Cuba. According to E. Howard Hunt, Alpha 66 and Veciana were handled for the agency by his good friend CIA officer David Atlee Phillips. Veciana milked the operation for maximum publicity, Phillips' specialty. Outraged at the unauthorized and dangerous attack on a Russian ship, JFK had the U.S. State Department immediately condemn the raid. It's highly unlikely that Phillips would have ordered Veciana to undertake the attack, which could have led to a new confrontation between the United States and the Soviets, without Helms' approval. While the Kennedys wanted Alpha 66 and Veciana to receive no CIA assistance, Helms, without informing JFK or RFK, told Phillips to continue supervising Veciana and his group. Also, in 1963, Richard Helms approved an even more outrageous provocation, one that endangered the lives of three imprisoned CIA agents as well as JFK's personal emissary, who was then trying to negotiate their release. Three agents were among the last 27 U.S. citizens still held in Cuban prisons. From January through April 1963, JFK had prominent New York attorney James Donovan working to secure their release. Donovan had helped Robert Kennedy negotiate the release of the Bay of Pigs prisoners, and his rapport with the Cuban government soon translated to a working relationship with Fidel, which included accompanying the Cuban leader on skin diving trips. The CIA developed two plans to assassinate Fidel while he was skin diving with Donovan, something the agency admitted both in internal reports and in congressional testimony. One plan involved devising an exotic seashell to attract Fidel's attention in an area where Castro commonly went skin diving. However, the shell would actually be rigged to explode underwater, killing Castro and anyone who might be with him. CIA Technical Services, the same group that created the poison pills for the mafia to use against Fidel, explored the idea, but found too many problems. The second plan involved having James Donovan present Castro with a contaminated diving suit as a gift. CIA Technical Services actually bought a diving suit, dusted the inside with a deadly fungus, and contaminated the breathing apparatus with tuberculosis bacteria. The only reason the plan was abandoned was because Donovan gave Castro a different diving suit on his own initiative, and Helms later testified that the poisoned diving suit never left the CIA. The lethal plans approved by Helms were never revealed to Donovan, CIA Director McCone, JFK, or RFK. Donovan was already in some danger since the CIA's March 1963 and April 1963 assassination operations, about which Donovan knew nothing, were being planned while he was in Cuba negotiating with Fidel. Ironically, Castro actually talked with Donovan about the CIA's attempts to kill him while the men were on a skin-diving excursion. For decades, and even today, former CIA personnel, in books and interviews, give the impression that the CIA undertook efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro only because President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy pressed it to do so. However, the facts show a different story. The CIA fully admits to many well-documented Castro assassination attempts that were not authorized by JFK, RFK, even CIA Director John McCone. More importantly, the CIA's attempts to assassinate Fidel began before JFK became president and continued long after he was dead. In a private meeting with President Kennedy on April 15, 1963, CIA Director McCone advised him to either establish relations with Castro or to overthrow him. Surprisingly, JFK suggested that both options might simultaneously be pursued, a dual strategy that would become a reality by the fall. McCone followed up his meeting with a memo saying that a military coup in Cuba was the United States' only hope to resolve the Cuba situation. 2 days before McCone's memo, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara told a National Security Council subcommittee that Castro must be overthrown, preferably by provoking an internal revolt that would allow the United States military to intervene. U.S. officials made two attempts to identify Cuban military leaders willing to lead a revolt. A CIA operation named Amtrunk, which involved New York Times journalist Tad Schultz and a CIA task force with the recently created Defense Intelligence Agency, an umbrella agency designed to coordinate the intelligence services of all U.S. military branches. Neither was producing results, especially since most of the power in Cuba was concentrated in the hands of a relatively small number of officials that Fidel trusted. Frustrated by the lack of progress, having no clear strategy, and lacking time to give the difficult situation the attention it needed, JFK delegated Cuba to Robert Kennedy. However, the constant bickering and never-ending requests for money by Cuban exile groups receiving CIA support quickly frustrated RFK. In addition, the extensive attention RFK gave to Cuban matters was on top of an already full plate of activities he had to oversee as Attorney General, issues ranging from civil rights matters to the war on organized crime. Robert Kennedy turned to his exile friend Harry Williams, telling him he didn't want any more Cuban exile leaders coming to RFK for money. Instead, the exiles were to go through Williams, who would then identify for RFK the select few he thought were serious and deserved U.S. backing. By using Williams, RFK also established his own channel into the exile community so he wouldn't be completely dependent on the CIA. RFK turned to Williams because they had grown increasingly close since the Bay of Pigs prisoner release. A frequent visitor at RFK's Hickory Hill estate, Williams even stayed at RFK's New York apartment on visits to Manhattan. The fact that Williams was close to and trusted by RFK has been confirmed in accounts by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Haynes Johnson, Newsweek editor Evan Thomas, and historian Richard Mahoney. Thomas wrote, "Increasingly, through 1963, RFK relied on Harry Williams, organizing and motivating the others to keep the pressure on Castro." Years later, Haynes Johnson wrote in the Washington Post that of all the Cuban leaders of the Bay of Pigs invasion, Williams was the closest such person to the JFK administration in 1963. Word soon spread in the exile community, and even in Cuba, that Williams was essentially the gatekeeper for RFK and JFK. Those wanting the support of either man would have to go through Williams. Marcello, Traficante, and Rosselli took notice as well. Rosselli used mob money to fund a phony Cuban exile group, the JGCE, Junta of the Government of Cuba in Exile, run by Paulino Sierra. CIA agent Bernard Barker, also working for Traficante, helped spread the word about the new group. The mob bosses wanted Sierra's group to get Williams and the Kennedys' blessing, in which case it could be used as cover for the plot to kill JFK. However, a journalist raised suspicions about Sierra's mafia funding in May 1963, and my interview with Sierra's daughter confirmed Sierra's ties to the mob. Sierra's group lingered for several months, but it never received the backing of Williams or the Kennedys, and thus was of no real use in the JFK plot. A May 10, 1963 Associated Press report that would have a huge impact on the secrecy surrounding JFK's assassination appeared in the New York Times and other newspapers. Long overlooked, the article gave surprising details about Harry Williams' work for Robert Kennedy, information that both men had hoped to keep out of the press. A new all-out drive to unify Cuban refugees into a single, powerful organization to topple the Fidel Castro regime was disclosed today by exile sources. The plan calls for formation of a junta in exile to mount a three-pronged thrust consisting of sabotage, infiltration, and ultimate invasion. The exile sources said the plan had been discussed with Cuban leaders by U.S. Central Intelligence agents. Seeking to put together the junta was Enrique Harry Ruiz Williams, a Bay of Pigs invasion veteran and friend of U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. Tony Varona, former premier of Cuba, said he had told Mr. Ruiz Williams he would cooperate in plans to unify the exiles. RFK and Harry Williams were furious when they saw the article revealing information about their secret plans. The information was probably leaked by Tony Varona, who had volunteered to become the first exile leader to join Williams's operation, no doubt at the urging of Santo Traficante. Varona had worked on the CIA mafia plots with Traficante and Rosselli, and he was still working for Traficante in 1963. That Varona was working on behalf of Traficante and the Mafia was confirmed soon after Varona began working with Williams, when the CIA received a report that Rosselli's associates had paid a bribe of $200,000 to Varona. Neither RFK nor Williams knew about Varona's work for Traficante and Rosselli, or about the ongoing CIA Mafia plots, and the CIA never informed RFK about Varona's bribe from the Mafia. Thus, the Kennedys' covert plans for Cuba were penetrated by Traficante almost from the start. However, the May 10, 1963 AP article quickly caught the attention of Commander Juan Almeida, Williams' old friend in Cuba, still head of the Cuban Army. Commander Almeida reached out to Williams within 48 hours of seeing the article, getting a message to him to call a certain number in Cuba, a line that was safe from wiretaps. Almeida helped oversee some of Cuba's electronic surveillance operations. At that time, Almeida was in many ways the third most powerful official in Cuba, behind only Fidel and his brother Raúl Castro, and he wielded far more authority and men than Che Guevara. Commander Almeida told Williams that Fidel was becoming nothing more than a dictator, betraying the very revolution they had all fought so hard for. Then, Almeida surprised Williams by offering to stage a coup against Fidel if JFK would back him. As soon as he got off the phone, Williams immediately called Robert Kennedy about Almeida's offer. Williams and RFK were in near daily contact by May 1963, and Williams appears often in RFK's official Justice Department phone logs. Williams also made many calls and visits to RFK's Virginia home, Hickory Hill, and to his New York City apartment. Robert Kennedy wasted no time in discussing Almeida's offer with President Kennedy, since this appeared to be the big break regarding Cuba they'd been hoping for. RFK's official phone logs at the National Archives indicate some of the timing. The logs show that on May 13, 1963, at 5:50 p.m., RFK took a call from President Kennedy. The very next call RFK accepted, at 6:05 p.m., was from Harry Williams. RFK told Williams that JFK had decided to accept Almeida's offer to stage a coup to overthrow Fidel, and that the U.S. government would give Almeida its full backing for the attempt. That was the start of the JFK-Almeida coup plan, one of the most secret, covert U.S. operations since D-Day. In fact, that very term was used on May 29, 1963, just over 2 weeks after Almeida contacted the Kennedys via Williams, when Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Maxwell Taylor wrote a memo saying that it was a matter of priority to examine the possibility of an invasion of Cuba at a time controlled by the United States in order to overthrow the Castro government. The memo included a proposed date for D-Day. Select officials at the Pentagon later played major roles in the JFK Almeida coup plan, with the CIA relegated to supporting status. Williams and other aides to John and Robert Kennedy, including Secretary of State Dean Rusk, who also gave an on-the-record confirmation to Vanity Fair, verified the JFK Almeida coup plan to me. Though the vast majority of files about the plan are still classified, a surprising number have slipped through. They include a 1963 CIA report to the agency's director, with information from Bernard Barker about an operation including Juan Almeida designed to overthrow Fidel, who would be replaced by a new Cuban government to be recognized immediately by JFK's administration. Another CIA dispatch discusses a plan for an internal uprising in Cuba by Cuban military figures who are conspiring against Fidel Castro. Among the key figures in the plot is Juan Almeida. Hundreds of pages of files about the U.S. military side of the operation have been declassified. The JFK Almeida coup plan was designed to avoid the main problems that befell the Bay of Pigs operation, which had been a relatively open secret known to dozens of officials, aides, agents, and military officers in the U.S. government, as well as to numerous journalists and even partially to Fidel. This time, any knowledge of the coup plan would be tightly held. Only about a dozen people, including JFK, RFK, CIA Director John McCone, and CIA Deputy Director for Plans Richard Helms, would know the full scope of the plan. The leading U.S. role in the coup plan was never supposed to be revealed, even after the coup succeeded, and not even years later, since U.S. officials hoped Almeida and trusted exiles might play roles in Cuba's new government for decades to come. If things worked as JFK and RFK hoped, it would simply appear as though JFK had responded well to the unexpected situation of Fidel's elimination, the term the Kennedys used with their aides. In the 5 months of strategizing about Cuba before Almeida's offer in May 1963, General Maxwell Taylor and other top officials had approved three drafts of a purely hypothetical plan for a coup in Cuba. After Almeida's offer was relayed to the Kennedys, the planning took on a new sense of urgency. In just the next 4 months, 10 drafts were completed, some growing to more than 80 pages. Officials at the CIA and State Department reviewed and approved them all. At that point, no one at State knew about Almeida, and Dean Rusk would be told about him only after JFK's death. Thus, most, but not all, of those working on these drafts thought they were only contingency plans, just in case a ranking Cuban official could be found to lead a coup. Only about a dozen officials knew the plans were not just a contingency, they were for real. And one of the highest officials in Cuba was already working with JFK. However, these drafts still give a surprisingly accurate overview of the coup plan. None of those files were declassified for over three decades, until the mid-1990s, partially as a result of information I provided to the staff of the JFK Assassination Records Review Board. According to the plans, the Cuban leader of the coup had to have some power base in the Cuban army, and the United States would also seek the cooperation of selected Cuban exile leaders. The point of the plan was to stage a seemingly internal palace coup in Cuba that would neutralize the top echelon of Cuban leadership. The plan stresses that it is important that the revolt appear genuine and not open to the charge of being a facade for a forcible U.S. overthrow of Castro, since a well-planned and successful rescue of a revolt could be made politically acceptable to U.S. allies and the Soviets. After Castro's death, President Kennedy would warn the Soviets not to intervene. The leaders of the coup would have announced via radio and other means the establishment of a provisional government. They would have appealed to the U.S. for recognition and support, particularly for air cover and a naval blockade, ostensibly to make certain that the Soviets do not intervene, but actually, by prearrangement, to immobilize the Cuban Air Force and Navy. That was important, since 12 to 13,000 Soviet military personnel of all kinds remain in Cuba. After completion of such initial air attacks as may be necessary, provision will be made for the rapid, incremental introduction of balanced forces to include full-scale invasion. However, it's important to point out that full-scale invasion was a worst-case scenario that JFK and others hoped wouldn't happen. It was possible that Commander Almeida could stage the coup without U.S. military forces. A multiracial group of Cuban-American Bay of Pigs veterans, commanded by a black exile officer, was soon training at Fort Benning and Fort Jackson. They would be the first U.S. troops into Cuba if U.S. military forces were needed on the ground. In fact, Commander Almeida could actually ask for the intervention of U.S. forces to help prevent a Soviet takeover of Cuba. A careful reading of all the declassified files and of exclusive interviews with participants in the coup plan shows it was even possible that U.S. military forces could wind up fighting side by side with Commander Almeida's Cuban troops against forces backing Raúl Castro or old-line Cuban communists. JFK's plan for a coup in Cuba with Almeida was vastly different from the CIA mafia plots. The United States wanted support from its allies, and the Kennedys' ultimate goal was a free and democratic Cuba. According to the plans, the OAS, Organization of American States, will send representatives to the island to assist the provisional government in preparing for and conduct of free elections. The provisional government would include the Cuban America exile troops and the leaders of four exile groups who would secure bases outside the United States prior to the coup. The four exile leaders would represent a broad spectrum of politics, from the ultra-conservative Manuel Artime, E. Howard Hunt's best friend, to the extremely liberal Manolo Rey and his group JURE, and Eloy Manoyo and his SNFE. Among them, unfortunately, was Tony Varona, who was working for the mafia. Within several months, CIA memos began to describe those disparate groups as working on a major plot to overthrow Castro. As mentioned, one CIA memo noted that Manolo Rey's JURE was currently sponsoring a plan to assassinate Fidel Castro and other high-ranking Cuban government officials as part of an operation designed to incite an internal rebellion in Cuba. The same memo says, "This plan involves an internal uprising with the support of certain Cuban military figures. Among the key figures in the plot are Juan Almeida." The American public knew nothing about the JFK-Almeida coup plan for decades. Finally, some documents were declassified in the 1990s, but the few mentioning Almeida were separate from the files about the plan for a coup in Cuba. So most historians thought the plans were only a what-if contingency. The JFK-Almeida coup plan didn't start to become fully exposed until 2006, after the U.S. government sent me a written determination that some files describing Commander Almeida's secret work for JFK could be released. The secrecy surrounding the JFK-Almeida coup plan helps explain why so much related to JFK's assassination stayed secret for so long. Nonetheless, a surprising number of documents slipped through over the years, though some of their significance is clear to historians only now, in hindsight. Among those documents are files about Tony Varona's summer of 1963 $200,000 bribe from the mafia. Other memos, such as two from June 1963, outline the goals of John and Robert Kennedy. The ultimate objective was for dissident elements in the military of the Cuban regime to bring about the eventual liquidation of Fidel Castro and the elimination of the Soviet presence from Cuba. The handful of exile leaders who were willing to do that, chosen by Harry Williams and approved by RFK, would receive major funding from the Kennedy administration to base their operations outside the territory of the United States. those exiles had to be dedicated to the idea that the overthrow of Castro must be accomplished by Cubans inside and outside Cuba working in concert. In addition, an experienced CIA liaison officer would be assigned to each group to provide general advice, funds, and material support. Although the groups would be called autonomous, RFK made it clear they were really working for the United States, but if ever charged with complicity, the U.S. government would publicly deny any participation in the group's activities.